Global Cooling Radio.
Global Cooling Radio.
A production of ClimateGateCountryClub.com.
The world's largest networking site for skeptics.
Welcome to Global Cooling Radio. I'm Mark Gillar, and our special guest today is Steve Malloy, the author of Green Hell. Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Listen, let's just start right with the title of the book. If environmental greenies have their way, define what green hell will be like for the average individual living in America.
Well, green hell is going to be a lot like life was under the Soviet Union because, of course, nothing that the Greens want to do is about the environment. Nothing's going to improve the environment. This is all about social control, social and political power. And, you know, what they couldn't achieve by coming out and saying, yeah, we're communist, socialist, whatever, they can achieve through environmental laws and regulations.
So essentially green is the new red.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these people want to tell you where to live, where to work, how many children you can have, how much energy you can use, how much water you can have, what kind of food you should be eating. In California, they're already trying to tell people what color car they can drive.
And what's the purpose of that? They all have to have white cars to reflect the heat or what?
In California, they want to ban black and dark-colored cars because, you know, of course, you know, in the summer, those cars trap more radiation, get warmer, use more air conditioning. Of course, air conditioning, causes people to use more gas, and, you know, they just go on and causes global warming. So there you go.
Well, pretty much everything causes global warming. I read in your book that bottled water causes global warming, or at least greenies.
Well, that's true. No, that's true, and that's why I say, I mean, there's no facet of our lives that the greens want to leave untouched. What we eat, what we drink, where we work, how many children we have, how much energy, what we drive, what kind of clothes we wear. I mean, every aspect of our lives, these people want to control.
Well, now, one of the things that I noticed about your book that I really liked is that you sort of set yourself up in a way that they can't attack you because you make most of your points by quoting them.
Right. Green Hell is all about showing the reader what the Greens want to do in the Greens' own language. It's not Steve Malloy making it up. I'm not extrapolating. I'm using their own language. It's kind of like Barack Obama coming out last year and saying, well, if my form of cap and trade gets enacted, then, you know, electricity prices will necessarily skyrocket.
I saw that, and he also said in the same breath that he was going to bankrupt the coal industry, and people clapped their hands together like a bunch of seals and said, yeah, hope change, bring it on.
Right, and, absolutely. And then at one point on the campaign trail, he was talking about how, you know, we can't drive our SUVs anymore, we can't eat as much as we want anymore, we can't keep our homes at 72 degrees anymore. You got to take the guy at his word. And I take the Greens at their word, and they want to radically transform the way we live.
My understanding is the White House thermostat is kept a little lower than 72.
Right. That's a story that was broken on the front page of the New York Times. Apparently, Barack Obama keeps the White House, the Oval Office, so warm that he has to work in shirt sleeves. I believe it was David Axelrod
who
said that he likes to keep it warm enough to grow orchids. But you need to freeze your rear end off.
I mean, he was raised in Hawaii, and he apparently likes it warm. That's the story. I was thinking he liked it cooler in the summer, but he actually likes it warmer in the winter. Also, this brings up an interesting point, and I like to say that green rules are for the little people. Barack Obama is hardly the only green that leads a somewhat hypocritical lifestyle. Would you mind pointing out a few others for us?
Oh, sure. I mean, probably the most well-known offender is going to be Al Gore. Al Gore, you know, is constantly berating us about, you know, what our carbon footprints are, and he's jetting around the world in private jets. He rides around in limos. His electricity use is like 20 times the average American's. He's got an indoor pool that costs $600 a month to heat. He has a houseboat.
Right.
it's just outrageous. So he's one. You've got the Google guys, you know, they're constantly, you know, sort of subtly trying to brainwash people into being green. Of course, they have their own Boeing 757 party jet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
know, Richard Branson. Yeah, Richard Branson, not only, you know, he owns Virgin Airways. I mean, the guy buys islands so that people can sail out to them in their private yachts and they can party. Come on.
Again, I think a lot of these people feel that when they make these comments, they're making them for the masses and that there are different rules for different people. And obviously, if you're very wealthy, you shouldn't have to confine yourself to the lifestyle that they want the rest of us to live. Now, what's interesting to me on this is that whenever the Greens try to defend Al Gore, I mean, one of the first things they'll come out with is, well, do you really expect the former vice president of the United States to fly coach? Well, you know, in all honesty, I don't. But does he have to have
a
houseboat?
Well, I don't know. I mean, do you think Dan Quayle flies around in private jets? And what's so special about Al Gore?
Yeah, good point.
You know, I mean, you could look. You got to walk the walk, right? Otherwise, what are you doing? I mean, he's just being like Joe Stalin. You know, everyone else is living in misery while you've got, you know, several dodges. You know?
That's about what we're seeing, but you know the mainstream media really never calls him on that. I mean, I've yet to see a Katie Couric, and I brought this up last week, but you know there's this 30-minute interview posted on the CBS website, and it is a love fest of an interview. I mean, I make no pretense about being a journalist. I'm a hardcore skeptic, and I'm trying to give fellow skeptics a voice with this show, and I don't deny that. But Katie Couric, I mean, it's the person who sits at the desk of the CBS Evening News, I think has an obligation not to forsake her journalistic standards. Her I guess, objectivity should always be present no matter how she feels personally. And yet, I watched her do a 30-minute interview with Al Gore, and there was not one tough question. In that entire time, you would think she could have mustered a, hey, Al, if you're really so worried about carbon footprints, why do you have a houseboat? I mean, I don't understand.
Yeah, look, I mean, look. First of all, you know, I would just say with mainstream media, you know, standards are out the window. These people have no standard. You know, they have a political agenda, and they're trying to implement it. Second of all, I would say that Al Gore, you can bet that Al Gore listed as a guarantee that she would not ask him any embarrassing questions.
Well, my understanding is he's got a pretty strict list of rules when he goes on to an interview. So.
Yeah. So right. So you can't ask him anything tough. The mainstream media is in the tank for global warming to start with, and every other left-wing cause. So, you know, what can you expect?
Let me ask you this. I mean, we've talked about the fact that, you know, all this is based around global warming right now, but haven't they tried to take control of our lives given or via other scares in the past?
I mean, they certainly tried to shape how we live our lives, but I think that global warming, you know, has been their most successful scam because, you know, since it's based around energy use, and energy is the lifeblood of our economy and of our lives, it's just this sort of unique thread through which they can control virtually everything that is done in society.
Well, speaking of that, we have an email a question that came in via email for you. It's from Russell in Arizona. And you had just mentioned, this is what triggered me to refer to this, that it's the most successful thing they've done. One of the things he talks about, and apparently he got this off your website, which is junkscience.com, is that the ozone action people had not been very successful at raising money whenever they were trying to, you know, solve the problem of ozone depletion. But once they switched over to global warming, all of a sudden it was like they hit the jackpot at the end of the rainbow.
Well, I mean, look, ozone is a very narrow field. The only company that could really make money off the ozone depletion scare was DuPont, and there was only a, you know, limited amount of political control that could be gained through the Montreal Protocol and banning ozone. But when you talk about energy, when you talk about controlling, you know, our cars and our homes and our businesses and, you know, what the prices of, you know, production of goods and services, I mean, there's a lot more at stake. And then you've got, you know, all these people that want to, all, you know, the parasites of society that want to profit off government regulation. Yeah, and there's just trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars at stake, which was never the case with ozone depletion.
Gotcha. Now, I want to give you a chance to do something that the Greens are always doing with the skeptics. That is, they want to connect the dots. Every single one of us, I mean, first of all, we make this very clear. Global Cooling Radio is 100% self-funded by me, as is the HootervilleGazette.com, as is the ClimateGateCountryClub.com. I pay for everything. I don't ask anybody for anything. I have put up some affiliate ads. I think right now they say they owe me $9.28, and when I get to $100, they'll cut me a check. So I'm not getting any money from Big Oil. I'm not getting any money from Big Coal. There is no one behind the scenes manipulating me with money.
Yeah.
But whenever you hear the greenies talk about this, the first thing they say is anyone who doubts the overwhelming proof, scientific proof, of anthropogenic global warming obviously is on the take from the traditional energy companies. They always try to play that little connect the dot game, but yet nobody in the mainstream media ever wants to play connect the dots with maybe why all three of GE's television networks backed Barack Obama, or how some of the major banks around the globe would profit from this. So I'm going to give you a chance to fire back. Talk to me about some of the companies,
General Electric wants a federal law requiring electric utilities to buy its wind turbines and its solar panels. I mean, there's, you know, many, many, many billions of dollars at stake for GE if they can get some sort of global warming scheme in place. Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms, Goldman Sachs owns the exchanges where carbon credits would be traded, carbon credits that would be issued under a cap-and-trade regime. Al Gore and his venture capital firm Kleiner Perkins, they have invested $1.5 billion in about 60 companies that are all cap and trade dependent or, you know, green stimulus dependent. So, you know, there is a real financial component to global warming alarmism. I mean, it's not, you know, I don't think it's the most important component, but it's a very important component for getting the issue front center in Congress.
Well, are we in a situation where, like we've been with many other environmental issues, where the foot soldiers at the bottom, you know, the college students, the nice people who just want to do something good for the planet, perhaps don't really understand the motives behind the upper echelon people?
You know, I think it's very nice that we gave 18-year-olds the right to vote, and I love college students. I used to be one, but
yeah, me too.
I have no idea. They have no idea what they're doing. I mean, the college students that think they're green and are working for the green cause and are protesting, I mean, these people are just fools. And they're too young, they're too inexperienced, they're just frankly too ignorant to understand what they're really doing. You know, by definition, they don't know anything. That's why they're in college. And as anyone who's been through college knows, college teaches you little. You know, it's not until you get to be older and you really get a better understanding of how the world works, how the economy works, how goods and services are produced, you know, meeting payrolls, doing things like that, that you really kind of get a feel for how the world works.
Well, you know, I'd have to agree with that. Right now, they see it as being a very black and white issue. Either you want to pollute the planet, put smog into the air, you know, make the streams and water reserves filthy, or you're a nice person who cares about the planet and wants to take care of the planet. The idea that there are people behind the scenes who are going to get rich trading carbon credits, you know, get rich selling the new energy-efficient appliances for your home, the idea that there are people behind the scenes who, frankly, couldn't care less about the environment and just want to make a buck isn't something that's really registered with them. I'm sure, like me, you've seen those YouTube videos of the 350.com kids putting signs on Lord Monckton's back and interrupting his meetings. And, you know, and it's just obvious that they think what they're doing is right, but then again, they really don't know what they're doing. Let's talk about the students, though, because we're focusing on college students right now. And as you make the point in your book, I mean, they really start inculcating this stuff at a very early age.
Oh, yeah. It's no surprise that college students are green and think they know everything because, you know, this brainwashing now starts as early as second grade. A few years ago, the Rainforest Action Network took second graders out of a public school during the school day to downtown Manhattan to protest J.P. Morgan Chase, the bank. They protested the environmental policies. I mean, this is crazy. These kids can't even spell bank. I'm not even quite sure if they knew all the letters in the word bank. But here they are protesting. I mean, you know, you talk about child exploitation and ideological child abuse, I mean, that was like the poster child for it, no pun intended.
Well, speaking of poster, one of my favorite ones, and some of my regular listeners are going to hear me say this, but if you go to treehugger.com, they've got this one with a little girl, looks like she's about in first grade, standing on a block of ice, noose around her neck, and the message is clear. If you don't do something to stop global warming, this little girl's going to die. And I just think that's so irresponsible. The Build-A-Bear people have used Santa Claus to push global warming. I mean, we have seen so many. If you saw the film they opened with in Copenhagen, the girl running from the flood. And you know, kids think that, you know, hell, the end of the world is right around the corner thanks to the, green.
I hesitate to use this anecdote because it appeared in mainstream media, but in the Washington Post a few years ago, there was a front-page article about how young children in elementary school are actually being tormented about global warming. You know, when I was a little boy in the late 1960s, you know, sometimes I would worry about, like, what happens if there was nuclear war. Well, these kids are having the same kind of fantasy about global warming.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's mind-boggling.
Sure. I mean, in fact, I grew up in that same time period. I'm 47, and I can remember doing the little drills where you hide under a desk as if a nuclear bomb going off in your close proximity would somehow, you know, be not dangerous to you if you were covered by a desk. But
right.
At any rate, and I remember that. And talk to me, since I've got somebody on the air that probably remembers the same TV shows and the same presidents. Do you recall on Saturday mornings, back whenever you could only get cartoons on Saturday morning, that they used to have this little segment called In the News, and this guy named Christopher Glenn, I forgot what network he was with, would come on and talk about the latest news events. And I remember so distinctly to this day that he said the Earth was heading into another ice age. And my response to that was, boy, I better tell Mom to get me a warm coat. But go ahead.
Yeah. I don't remember that, but I do remember that in the mid-70s, you know, cover of Time, Newsweek was, you know, the coming ice age. And this is where climate alarmism started, you know, the coming ice age, which turned into global warming, which, when that didn't work out, became climate change, and when that really wasn't working out too well, it became weather change. And so now, anytime there's bad weather, you know, you can bet there's some activist group out there blaming it on man-made CO2 emissions.
We're not just seeing a scare about global warming right now. Noting that bottled water causes global warming, the Greens are against that. We also know that there apparently, according to the Greens, is some kind of a major water shortage. And they're not shy about going after people like Lance Armstrong, who's about 100 miles from me right now, you know, as far as saying, hey, you're a water hog, you're using too much water. And they sort of shame these celebrities into getting involved. Bad enough that we've got the global warming stuff going on. Now we've got there's a water shortage. Of course, global warming causes floods and drought, but somehow it's leading to a water shortage. And there's the whole issue with bottled water. Separate those issues for us and help us understand them.
Well, let's just, you know, the environmentalists, not only have they figured out that energy is very important to us, they've also figured out that water is very important to us. And so they've gone about making getting water extremely difficult. And this is most important to farmers, especially in California. Mm-hmm. You know, the environmentalists are using the Endangered Species Act to block water delivery to farmers. And, you know, California produces about 10-12% of our agriculture. So they are, you know, in their jihad against development and farming, they're using the water weapon. And however they can, you know, block water from getting to farmers, they're doing it, whether it's endangered species or, you know, they just passed a law putting the Great Lakes off limits. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, water is the most abundant substance on the face of this planet, and mm-hmm. we have the technology to not only export water to areas that it's needed, we can also desalinate water. But they won't let us do that. And, you know, it's all part of their strategy to control our lives. Now, the bottled water issue, that was a means of beating up companies that sold bottled water, like PepsiCo and Coca-Cola, getting them to toe the line on global warming. You know, they said that, oh, it, you know, not only does it, is plastic used in making the bottles that contain the water, but, you know, it costs a lot of money to transport bottled water. And so, you know, they're very successful in getting the bottled water companies to you know, reformulate their product and do mea culpas and, you know, basically bring them in line. Of course, water companies never thought that, you know, like PepsiCo and Coca-Cola, you know, all their products come in plastic bottles, not just water. So you let the environmentalists beat you up on bottled water, well, what about Cherry Coke? I mean, isn't that a problem, too?
I guess the Greens haven't thought about that. I'm afraid you've probably given them
No, they have thought about it. The problem is that the soda companies haven't thought about it. So, you know, they think they're solving this problem by you know, reformulating bottled water. But, of course, the Greens are just going to come after them on soda as well and the other, you know, all drinks.
So that's yet to come.
That's yet to come, of course. You can never make people happy.
That's what I was going to say. I've always thought, okay, what if we could just wave a magic wand and give them everything they wanted? You know, cap and trade, done. What next? Oh, sure. No bottled water? Fine. I just have to wonder where they would draw the line. If they had, I mean, where would it end? I mean, where would this stuff end?
Well, it's only going to end when they run society. I mean, these people, you know, at the end of the Cold War, we threw them out the window red, and they have walked back in the front door green. What they want to do has got nothing to do with the environment. It's got nothing to do with improving anybody's health or making anyone's life better. This is strictly about political control of society. These people are socialists. When I grew up, we called them communists. I mean, they are totalitarians, and that is no exaggeration. You look at everything these people want to do, every solution they offer to every problem, whether that problem is real or imagined, it's always increased government control of what's going on.
They also think there are too many people, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's one of their original scares, you know, the Paul Ehrlich.
Population bomb, yeah.
Yeah, it's a population bomb, right. This continues through to today. I mean, Barack Obama's top science advisor, a guy named John Holdren, he's one of Paul Ehrlich's buddies, and in the 1970s he was advocating forced abortion as a means of population control. These people think that, you know, people are the problem.
Well, I know that in Anne McElhaney and Phelan McAleer's film, they've got that quote from Al Gore saying the problem is coal, cars, and people. And I got to be honest with you, I wasn't thrilled about coal and cars, but when he got to people, I took it personally. I did, you know, I'm like, hey, what's this guy saying that people are a problem? And if people truly are a problem, may I suggest that the environmentalists get off the planet first?
Yeah, no, these people are people haters. You know, look, even in the cold calculus of business, you know, business looks at people as resources. Environmentalists are the people with problems, okay? I mean, it's just, so even if you don't like business, at least business looks at them as resources.
Well, I want to congratulate you on writing this book. As I went through it, I know the one thing that happened to me is that I got mad. The same thing that happened whenever I originally, what got me started on this was reading Chris Horner's Red Hot Lies. And you get angry when you read this stuff because you really start to see, you know, which people are pulling the strings behind the scenes. So let's hope that everybody listening is getting mad right now and they're wanting to do something. Your book offers something that I think is very helpful, and that is a tutorial on how to fight back. Give our listeners some insight into what they can do to fight back against this nonsense.
Well, you know, Green Hell was written like a month before tea parties were born. And tea parties have just been a fantastic device for people to get out and show their concern and be active and get educated and do the right thing. Ultimately, you know, this is all about voting. But it starts with education and getting together with other people, understanding the issues. You know, read Green Hell. Try to apply it to your life, to your job, because undoubtedly this green stuff has hit people in their jobs. When you read the newspaper or the internet, whatever, you know, apply Green Hell to that, and then get out and get active. You know, most conservatives and libertarians have a tendency to be kind of laissez-faire, you know, after a hard day's work, being productive, want to come home, spend time with our families, kick back, you know, do our hobbies. Meanwhile, you know, folks on the left, I mean, they're not productive. All they do is rabble-rouse, and they're out at the county council planning commission meetings, or meeting with congressmen, state reps, whatever. They're trying to advance their social agenda. And unfortunately, you know, we're going to have to put aside some of our pastimes and become, you know, as active as they are. And tea parties are a great way to do that.
So we need to have green tea parties.
green tea parties. There you go.
One of our members at Climate Gate Country Club, Nancy, used you as a speaker at Green Tea Party, and she was quite happy with the results. So if anybody out there is interested in having a Green Tea Party, I'm guessing you're available to speak.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is an idea that I've talked about with Glenn Beck, and you know, it's a great idea. As a matter of fact, it's such a great idea that I've seen environmentalists try to co-opt the idea. I think New York Times columnist Tom Friedman last week commented about how we should have green tea parties. Of course, he's talking about it from a different perspective. But
right.
Whatever.
That's right. Yeah, and the liberals were going to have the coffee party too, right? I mean, we saw how long that lasted. So that's, you know, I mean, the thing is they, and I saw Glenn Beck speak live last Saturday evening, and, you know, they being the left, don't know what to do with the tea parties. At first, we were all a bunch of racists. It was all about the fact that our president was African American. You know, we were AstroTurf, you know, and now we're seditionists. You know, I mean, it's like they keep trying to come up with a new label. And the bottom line is none of it's going to stick. And the reason the coffee party isn't going to make it, and the reason the other green parties aren't, the tea parties aren't going to happen, is because right now I think our side's a little more enthused, a little more, you know, feeling that we're in a unique juncture in history and that something has to be done right now, or this socialism bulldozer is just going to run over our country.
That's absolutely right. You know, I've been doing this for 20 years. And for most of that time, environmentalists had free reign of grassroots activism because you couldn't get conservatives interested in, you know, most public policy issues, unless it was abortion-related, and you definitely couldn't get them interested in the environment. But you know what? The Tea Parties have changed all that. Thank you, Barack Obama.
Well, I think that's true. I can recall Ashley Judd just really attacking Sarah Palin and saying, wow, you know, shooting wolves from an airplane is just so inhumane. But then defending her position on partial birth abortion.
So I had a
group of conservatives. We were all, you know, at an informal lunch, and this one lady was saying, oh, this is horrible. How can you say that shooting wolves is inhumane but then defend partial birth abortion? And I said, so if an Ashley Judd movie comes to town, you want to grab a picket sign and we'll go out in front of the movie theater and, you know, highlight everyone? And there, she was like, oh, my God, no, that's not dignified. So, you know, that's the attitude.
Yeah, it's endlessly entertaining that, you know, if you know, environmentalists, you know, they're so worried about, you know, fetuses that are exposed to minute levels of chemicals that don't hurt, or, you know, a woman that's smoking, if they have no problem with just, like, ripping that kid out of the uterus. I mean, it's just crazy. They are crazy.
Was it Savage who said liberalism is a form of mental disease? I think he may have nailed it with that, because I don't understand this. Now, I will say this. There are some people out there who truly seem to believe. I mean, you've got Bill Nye, the science guy. You've got Ed Begley Jr., and they're constantly trying to out-geek each other. Apparently, they live in the same neighborhood. Everything they do is green. They ride bicycles everywhere they go. And, you know, I know there's some people out there that really believe, and they don't just talk the talk. They walk the walk. And, frankly, I feel these people are being used.
That's fine, Mark. I don't have a problem with those people as long as they keep their insanity to themselves. But they want to force it on me. Okay? So we are mortal enemies.
Well, since you said, you actually paraphrased something that Stuart Varney said when he was interviewing Ed Begley Jr. about don't force your green lifestyle on me. And Ed Begley Jr. said, hey, this is just like buying insurance for your house, which basically was his version of the precautionary principle. And I think there are two things about that. One is that it naively assumes that global warming hysteria isn't doing anything to harm people now, and it also assumes that there are no costs in the future if these people are wrong. They're like, oh, if we're wrong, no harm, no foul. I mean, we just cleaned up the air and cleaned up the water a little bit. Talk to me about their use, or perhaps we should say misuse, of the precautionary principle.
Well, you know, look, the precautionary principle, I think its application is like you wear a safety belt because, you know, there's a very real risk of getting into a car accident and being seriously hurt, so you wear a safety belt. They misuse the precautionary principle because they're simply making up these risks. There is no risk that the climate is going to be, you know, somehow harmed by man-made emissions of CO2. It's just physically impossible. And they offer, and if you don't believe that, well, they offer no evidence that there is any risk of harm. They want it to be true because they say it so. And of course that's simply not true. Okay, we, you know, with the car, with the seatbelts, there is a real risk. With the CO2, there's no evidence of any kind of risk. So I think the precautionary principle is completely inapplicable.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but one of the things that gets thrown at me is
neither are they. Neither is Ed Begley.
That's true. And I think Bill Nye is a mechanical engineer, so he probably hasn't had a whole lot of climatology training.
Yeah.
But one of the things that gets thrown at me as I dive into some of these science blogs, the Deltoid blog is my favorite one, is they'll say, well, you know, Mark, you're not a scientist, but if you were, you would realize that scientifically speaking, this issue was settled more than 100 years ago. And correct me if I'm wrong, I'd like you to speak to this. What was settled 100 years ago was that CO2 is capable of absorbing and retaining heat. But if I'm not mistaken,
well, of course, there's nobody disputes that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, but of course the physics of it is that, yeah, the first couple hundred parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere is very important. But you get to the level we're at now, you know, it's just not important. It doesn't really have a major impact on global temperature. And every molecule that is emitted has less of an effect than the molecule that was emitted before, because CO2 and temperature, the relationship is logarithmic in nature. You know, the more of it that goes in the atmosphere, it has less of an effect. And, you know, over the last 15 years, we've seen that there's been no global warming, although CO2 levels have increased by 10%. So we're at this level where it just really doesn't matter anymore.
Well, I think what we're seeing is an attempt to make draw short-term correlations. They have no way of explaining the cooling that took place in the 70s. They have no way of explaining the cooling that's taking place now. So
they can't explain anything. I mean, their models don't work. Nothing. They've been wrong for 20 years, ever since Jim Hansen testified in Congress. They've been wrong about everything. They've not been right about anything. I don't know why anyone believes any of these people.
Do you find it amusing that some of the people pushing global warming now were pushing global cooling back in the 70s?
Well, that gives you an idea of where they're coming from. It's, you know, anything to impose more government control over what we're doing.
Okay, so to make sure I understand this, no matter which way the thermometer is going, man, specifically industry, is responsible, and the solution is more taxing and more government control.
That's why we've gone to weather change, and anything that happens that's bad, or that somebody doesn't like, blame it on man.
Well, it's certainly been interesting to watch all this stuff, and, you know, hey, is one shill for big oil to another, I appreciate you coming on the show.
Anytime, Mark. Thank you very much for having me.
Once again, the name of the book is Green Hell, and one of the great things about doing this show over the Internet and keeping it there in archived format is that anybody listening to this show can simply look at their screen, see the copy of Green Hell, click on that, be immediately transported to Amazon.com, and place their order for this very, very important book. Steve, once again, thank you for being with us. Best of luck with all your future endeavors in this area, and hopefully we can have you back at some point.
Thank you, Mark. I look forward to it.
Global Cooling Radio.
Global Cooling Radio.
A production of ClimateGateCountryClub.com.
The world's largest networking site for skeptics.